This is Be the Story. This week, something a little different. Something that was inspired by Kate Wilhelm's book, Storyteller. The Storyteller and the Wordsmith. This is a dichotomy that Kate Wilhelm mentioned in her book, and something that has been mentioned on at least one other podcast. I'm one of those who believes this is not so much a dichotomy as two different ways of measuring stories. And both are important, as Kate Wilhelm points out. I want to explore both of these. And I want to take this general concept of the storyteller and the wordsmith and apply it to other forms of stories as well. I think we have a lot that we can learn by looking at how we tell our stories. And that's what I'm going to do this week on Be the Story. Welcome to Be the Story, celebrating stories and those who tell them. I'm Tim King, and we are now on daylight savings time. On, off, on, yes, on daylight savings time. It's the first Sunday in April, and all the clocks have been turned forward 1 hour, at least here in the eastern U.S. where I live. Fortunately, I have enough slack built into my sleeping schedule that I will not need to change it at all. All I need to do is go to sleep an hour later, wake up an hour later. Actually, just wake up an hour later and everything else will take care of itself. And if I want to move my sleeping schedule earlier, I could do it gradually. I have Steve Pavlina to thank for this great situation that I'm in, because it was an article that he wrote on his blog at stevepavlina.com that inspired me to try this sleeping schedule. Basically, the idea is that you wake up early, the same time every morning, set the alarm clock at first, and I did that. I didn't get up quite as early as I had originally planned, but still, 6 o'clock in the morning. And that gave me a few hours before I had to be at work. And that was a few productive hours. So you get up early in the morning, same time every morning, and you go to sleep when you're tired. But you have to pay attention to what your body is telling you, that when you're tired, you go to sleep. And the idea is that you kind of just settle into this natural sleep schedule. Now, you know, I'm used to waking up at 6 a.m. I don't even set the alarm anymore. You know, I just go to sleep when I'm tired and my body wakes me up at about 6 o'clock. It's absolutely great. So now I'm expecting that I'll wake up naturally at about 7 o'clock. We'll have to see. But in any case, 7 o'clock is plenty of time for me to get ready to, you know, get the kids off to school if I need to do that. And, even to get some productive work in, especially on BeTheStory.com, before I need to go to my day job. So that's absolutely great. It's very important to have a good sleep schedule, I'm finding. It's something that I did not do, actually, until I started with BeTheStory.com. And then I got very, very serious about pursuing personal development, not only for my own personal edification, but also so I could take on this project and not kind of just fall off the edge of the earth by pushing myself too hard, right? And so, on BeTheStory.com, this past Tuesday, I actually wrote about how you need to take care of yourself in order to be creative. This is something that was on my mind because other bloggers had mentioned that you need to take care of your body and you have to take care of your brain. And so often in all creative industries, I use the example of the software development industries or any sort of, if you're a software engineer, I'm sure you've seen how the whole industry basically pushes you to keep pushing yourself towards your absolute limit. And in some industries, like the game industry, from what I understand, new software developers especially are just pushed to the point that they burn out. And this is common practice and everyone just accepts it. And you can't do that if you want to maintain your creativity, to maintain your presence of mind, not to make mistakes, to be able to come up with innovative solutions that actually solve real problems. All right, I've vamped on that enough. The next day, Wednesday, March 29th, I talked about the X-Men a little bit. If I had to pick my favorite superheroes, they would be the X-Men. And if I had to pick my favorite single superhero, well, I'm not sure which one it would be, but it would have to be one of the X-Men. So what's so great about the X-Men? Well, I recently read the Astonishing X-Men comics, which reminded me of all the feelings that I experienced when I first saw the X-Men movies, which was my first exposure to the X-Men. The X-Men hold a special place in my heart because they're kind of they're another set of outlaw heroes, but they're not outlaws because they've broken the law. They're outlaws because they are mutants. They're unlike the other people in the world, and everyone else fears them because they're different. Also on Wednesday, I subscribe to the LinkedIn bloggers email group. This is an email list it's a Yahoo group actually, for bloggers who are on LinkedIn.com. And one of the projects that they're doing is called Blog Boost, in which group members post links on their blogs to a certain one of the other members' blogs. Anyway, the blog for this past week, the Blog Boost blog for this past week, was actually kind of interesting. Patsy Krakoff's Writing Great Easings and Blogs blog. Okay, enough of that. Thursday's Be the Story Spotlight. Smilla's Sense of Snow, the movie, not the novel. I haven't read the novel yet. It's on my list, along with about 3 zillion other books. Anyway, I remember Smilla's Sense of Snow, the movie, from 1997 when it came out. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert gave it 2 thumbs up, and I think they were right. So I talked about that a little. Friday, another way to generate better character ideas or better story ideas of any sort, throw 2 away. Yes, throw away 2 good ideas. And if you want to know why, read BeTheStory.com. On Friday, would you tell your story to help others? Pam Slim from the Escape from Cubicle Nation blog. By the way, Escape from Cubicle Nation, very cool blog. It's about getting out of the employee mindset, getting out of the wage slave kind of a mindset, and becoming an entrepreneur. Going out on your own, becoming independent. Anyway, what I really like about Escape from Cubicle Nation is the way Pam writes her articles. They just draw you in. When I first discovered Escape from Cubicle Nation, I looked at, I typically, when I look at a new blog, I typically look at, you know, the last whatever page or whatever of blog entries. This time I looked at this blog and I just had to read every single one from the headline, from the very first paragraph, just made me want to read more. I was so impressed. Anyway, this past week, she posted a link to her interview with Glenda Watson Hyatt regarding Glenda's autobiography entitled, I'll Do It Myself. And what's with that title? Well, Glenda has cerebral palsy. And this is her autobiography is, of course, the story of how she did it herself. And it sounds like it's going to be an incredibly inspirational story. Is this podcast getting longer or is it just my imagination? Well, we'll be right back to talk about the storyteller and the wordsmith. Stay tuned.
I'm bored.
I'm bored too.
Hey kids, look what I've got for you.
Kick-Ass Mystic Ninja Bits!
Yes, you asked for it, and here they are. Kick-Ass Mystic Ninja Bits are chock full of information, reviews, and links to exciting sci-fi sites with buttery goodness. So hurry up and go to www.kickassmysticninjas.com for your own tasty ninja bits today.
And they're educational too. Wow!
Roswell, UFOs,
Atlantis,
time travel,
Hollow Earth,
Dwarf,
underground bases,
reincarnation,
levitation,
prehistory,
giants,
abductions,
and the Pigman.
The Pigman? What on earth is the Pigman? To find out more on the Pigman and all the latest news from the other side, join me, Ben Grundy, for Mysterious Universe. Visit www.sohpodcast.com or search for Mysterious Universe in your favorite podcast directory.
Welcome back to Be the Story. This week I'm talking about the storyteller and the wordsmith. This is a dichotomy that Kate Wilhelm mentioned in her book, Storyteller. And it's a comparison that really resonated with me. Not so much because I believe there's a strict dichotomy, but there are two different ways to approach writing a story. And they're not mutually exclusive. They're more like two aspects to any writer's personality. I once worked at a larger employer than I do now. One thing that you get in a larger company, one of the perks, is that they often have on-site seminars that you can sign up for. And one of these that I took was on communication techniques. And part of this seminar was a communication styles evaluation. And we could determine which communication styles each of us was more comfortable with, which ones we used more, and which communication styles we did not use. So some of us were more abstract in the way that we talked and the way we communicated with others. Other people were more down to earth, more concrete. Some people were more logical in the way that they talked and the way that they thought, and other people were more emotional. You know, they relied on sensing what other people were feeling. And when I took this instrument, we knew right from the start that there were no right or wrong answers. This was simply an evaluation for your own personal edification so that you can know which of these communication styles you tended to rely upon. And I fully expected that when we got to the end, that the people running the seminar were going to tell us that, all right, now you know your communication style, and now you know how to interact with other people. That's not what they said. Not exactly. Here's what they said, that if you rely on one or two of the communication styles primarily, then you are not fully developing yourself. That if some of the communication styles you tend to neglect, well, you should tend to try them out more. Strengthen those parts of you. Because we're all a mix of all these different styles, if you will. No one person is just a logical being or just an emotional being. We are all both logical and emotional. And sometimes we have to rely on our logical side. Sometimes we have to rely on our emotional side. We are all both conceptual and sensual, you know, down to earth. And sometimes we have to rely on our touch it, feel it, see it side. And sometimes we have to talk about broad abstractions and concepts, and we have to tie the two together. And the person who can float or adjust and use each of these styles as the situation demands it is going to get ahead a lot further. It's the same way with being a storyteller or being a wordsmith. We need both in an effective story. Here's what Kate Wilhelm wrote in Storyteller about the wordsmith and the storyteller. I think of it as surface and depth, with the full understanding that it is much more complex than that. But it was a starting point. A good story is one in which the surface and depth are fused into one inseparable whole. Beautiful language, unique imagery, subtle symbolism over nothing is not a good story. Neither is a story obscured by bad word choices, awkward phrases that conceal meaning rather than reveal it, inappropriate symbolism or metaphors. We often encountered both types. So I wanted to give a few examples of what I thought were examples of being a wordsmith, being a storyteller, or being an effective combination of both. So, an example of a wordsmith. My mind immediately went to a short story that I read called The Dark Country by Dennis Etchison. This is a horror story, so it's a genre story, not something you would usually associate with the literary style of a pure wordsmith. But just listen to this. This is the very beginning of the story. Martin sat by the pool, the wind drying his hair. A fleshy airborne spider appeared on the edge of the book which he had been reading there. From this angle, it cast a long, pointed needle across the yellowing page. The sun was hot and clean. It went straight for his nose. Overweight American children practiced their volleyball on the bird-of-paradise plants. Weathered rattan furniture gathered dust beyond the peeling diving board. Traffic passed on the road, trucks, campers, bikes. The pool that would not be scraped till summer. The wooden chairs that had been ordered up from the States. Banana leaves, olive trees, a tennis court that might be done next year. A single-color TV antenna above the palms. By the slanted cement patio, heliotrope daisies, speckled climbing vines. The morning, a net of light on the water, boats fishing in Todos Santos Bay. A smell like shrimps, Veracruz, blowing off the silvered waves. And a strangely familiar island, like a hazy floating giant, where the humpback whales play. Yesterday in Ensenada, the car horns talking and a crab taco in his hand. He had wanted to buy a pair of huarachas and a Mexican shirt. The best tequila in the world for 3.5 a liter. Noche Buena beer. Foil labels that always peel before you can read them. Delicados con filtros cigarettes. bottles of agua mineral. Tehuachan con gas, no retornable. He smiled as he thought of churros at the blowhole, the maid who even washed his dishes, the Tivoli nightclub with Reno cocktail napkins, mezcal flavored with worm, eggs fresh from the nest, chorizo grease in the pan, bar girls with rhinestone-studded Aztec headbands, psychoactive liqueurs, seagulls like the tops of Valentine's, grilled corvina with lemon, the endless plumes of surf. And would you get to the point already? On the other side of the spectrum, we have, say, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, the novel by Anne Brashares, a very popular teen chick lit novel, and I don't mean that as a derogatory term, because, you know, frankly, I think this is a compelling story. Let me just read a little bit from one of the early chapters to give you an idea of what I mean by it being a compelling story, but weak in terms of the wordsmith side of things. The first thing was the front door. It was painted the most brilliant egg yolk over easy shade of yellow. Surrounding it, the house front was painted the brightest possible blue. Who could even imagine such a blue? Lena tipped her face upward to the cloudless afternoon sky. Oh. In Bethesda, if you painted your house these colors, they'd call you a drug addict. Your neighbors would sue you. They'd arrive with sprayers at nightfall and repaint it beige. Here was color bursting out everywhere against the whitewashed walls. Lena, go! Effie whined, shoving Lena's suitcase forward with her foot. Welcome, girls, welcome home, Grandma said, clapping her hands. Their grandfather fitted the key into the lock and swung open the sun-colored door. The combination of jet lag, sun, and these strange old people made Lena feel as if she were tripping, hypothetically, of course. She'd never actually tripped on anything except maybe a bad shrimp from Peking Garden once. If Lena was glazed and stupefied, Effie, without sleep, was just plain cranky. Lena always counted on her younger sister to do the blabbering, but Effie was too cranky even for that. So the drive from the tiny island airport had been mostly quiet. Grandma kept turning around in the front seat of their old Fiat, saying, "Look at you, girls! Oh, Lena, you are a beauty!" Lena seriously wished she would stop saying that because it was irritating, and besides, how was cranky Effie supposed to feel? So what are some of the things we can notice about this passage? Well, you see how Lena reacts to the beauty that's around her. And later in the story, you learn that she is an artist. And of course, then it really makes sense. It really clicks that, you know, she is just in art heaven with her easel and paints. You start to get a picture of what Lena's grandmother is thinking, and by the way that she is talking to Lena, and that plays into the story. So all these things are setting up a story arc, and it's not that boring, even though there is a fair amount of description. But though I say there's a fair amount of description, look at all the things that are missing. Can you tell me from this passage how the surrounding, that Lena here is visiting Greece, the island of Santorini. Can you tell me how it smells? No, you can't. Can you tell me how Lena feels on her skin? I mean, is it sunny? Is it hot? Can you tell me anything about any of the five senses except for the sense of sight? No. And it's one of the things I immediately noticed is there are all of these aspects that could be bearing upon how Lena is experiencing this story that would improve the way that we are experiencing it, since we are experiencing this part of the story through Lena's eyes, and yet Anne Brashares never draws on them. So, not very much of a wordsmith, but a pretty compelling story. And of course, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants is a very popular novel. But you don't have to choose between being a wordsmith and being a storyteller. you can be both. And so immediately what comes to mind, my mind, is a recent novel that I read, A Certain Slant of Light by Laura Whitcomb. One of the best novels I've read in a long time. I was trying to decide what part of it I should read. Really, it's all very good. I'll just read a little from the introduction, from the first chapter, and you can read more at Amazon.com in their preview section if you're interested. Someone was looking at me, a disturbing sensation if you're dead. I was with my teacher, Mr. Brown. As usual, we were in our classroom, that safe and wooden-walled box, the windows opening onto the grassy field to the west, the fading flag standing in the chalk-dust corner, the television mounted above the bulletin board like a sleeping eye, and Mr. Brown's princely table keeping watch over a regiment of student desks. At that moment, I was scribbling invisible comments in the margins of a paper left in Mr. Brown's tray, though my words were never read by the students. Sometimes Mr. Brown quoted me, all the same, while writing his own comments. Perhaps I couldn't tickle the inside of his ear, but I could reach the mysterious curves of his mind. Although I could not feel paper between my fingers, smell ink, or taste the tip of a pencil, I could see and hear the world with all the clarity of the living. They, on the other hand, did not see me as a shadow or a floating vapor. To the quick, I was empty air, or so I thought. As an apathetic girl read aloud from Nicholas Nickleby, as Mr. Brown began to daydream about how he had kept his wife awake the night before, as my spectral pen hovered over a misspelled word, I felt someone watching me. Not even my beloved Mr. Brown could see me with his eyes. I had been dead so long, hovering at the side of my hosts, seeing and hearing the world, but never being heard by anyone, and never, in all these long years, never being seen by human eyes. I held stone still while the room folded in around me like a closing hand. When I looked up, it was not in fear, but in wonder. My vision telescoped so that there was only a small hole in the darkness to see through, and that's where I found it, the face that was turned up to me. Wow, that gives me a little shiver just reading it. So we have these two components of telling a story. What do we do with them besides writing short stories and novels and other written forms? Well, one of the things that really resonated with me when I was reading Storyteller by Kate Wilhelm, and she made this dichotomy, right, was that the same types of dichotomy, if you will, dichotomies, can be applied to other media. So let's look at a few of these right after this message. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Ron from Griddle Cakes Radio. Are you looking for a family, work-safe podcast that'll make you smile? If so, swing by griddlecakes.com. Once there, you'll hear things such as a musician's trade organization threatening to sue Thomas Edison over his phonograph record machine.
They've made their living this way their entire careers, and you, Mr. Edison, you have taken this living away.
Yeah. I'm sorry you feel that way.
Well, we can't sit back and allow this piracy to go on any longer. Here.
What's this?
It's a cease and desist letter. You are to stop manufacturing phonograph record machines immediately.
You're kidding, right? Am I on candid camera?
Or, did you ever wonder what animals actually do at night? No. Wait. No. Cut. 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 Stop. What are you doing? You sound like a bunch of animals.
But we are animals.
But don't you see? We don't have to be. We can be much better than animals. We can be musicians.
Griddle Cakes Radio, exploring the lost art of audio storytelling. Check us out at www.griddlecakes.com.
Welcome back to Be the Story. We're talking about the storyteller and the wordsmith. This is a dichotomy that Kate Wilhelm drew in her book, Storyteller. But can we apply the same lesson that there is an aspect of storytelling which is concentrated or focused on the story, and another aspect which is focused on the words that we use to tell the story? Can we take this same lesson and apply it in other ways to stories in general? I think we can. You have on the one side the story. On the other side, you have the way that that story is expressed. Story is an abstraction. We find it very difficult to define exactly what the story is. It's not a novel, for example. You could say that the story is told by the novel or told in a novel, but a novel itself is not a story. Story is where the writer meets his audience. It's that area of overlap, that conceptual space where the message that we're trying to communicate is perceived by the people that we're trying to communicate it to. And so you have to pay attention, at least in part, to the story, or else you're not going to have an effective channel of communication. But by the same token, you need to give that story some sort of physical form, such as by words in a book. And if you can't do that effectively, then you're not going to have a story. Or you could have a great story, but it's going to be repressed, at least to some extent, by the fact that you're not using all of the tools at your disposal to make the story real, to make it vibrant, to make it come alive, to bring the reader to where that story is and make the reader live that story as though he's actually there. So what about movies? Maybe we could talk about the storyteller and the cinematographer. Just as authors, writers, tend to focus on the words being used and tend to forget about the story, filmmakers sometimes tend to concentrate on the cinematography and they forget about the story that that cinematography is supposed to express. So they're trying to draw the reader into these vibrant images, but they're forgetting that the reader needs a reason to want to be there. And sometimes they try very hard, but they forget exactly. They don't use all the story tools that are at their disposal. Off the top of my head, I think of the movie March of the Penguins, a documentary about a bunch of penguins. And that's essentially all it is. When you get down to the story part of it, they tried very hard to make it like a story where we're following these penguins and experiencing all the ups and downs of their year or their mating season, actually. But when it comes right down to it, it's just a bunch of penguins. Why do I care about a bunch of penguins? There's very little empathy I have for a bunch of penguins. So a few penguins die. Big deal. Now, if we had followed the journey of a couple of penguins who meet, fall in love, have a little baby penguin chick, and fight it through the harsh, harsh winter and all the dangers, and, you know, all of their friend penguins are falling by the wayside, and yet they are persevering. Now, that would be a story. That would be something that would draw us in, make us sympathize with these penguins by personifying them. In March of the Penguins, the narrator is always saying, but that's not the worst they're going to experience, or words to that effect, to try to heighten the tension. And yet, it is a feeble attempt at best, because we don't really care so much about a bunch of penguins. Well, my 7-year-old daughter cares. Well, she was 6 at the time. And, you know, she loves anything that's cute and fluffy. Very sensitive and empathetic girl. But you don't need to be you don't have to leave off the cinematography in order to be a great storyteller. Look at Citizen Kane, which was, by some people, it was criticized for its story, but it does have a compelling story, and it does draw you in. Maybe a better example might be something like the Godfather series. At least the first 2 installments in that series, which are just all-around great films. So, Smilla's Sense of Snow, which I reviewed recently. This is a 1997 kind of a weird sci-fi-ish flick, which was not billed, if I remember correctly, as a sci-fi flick. It has great cinematography, a great, you know, great filmmaking behind it, and a storytelling that is so compelling that even though nearer the end, the story concepts behind it, at least if you're not well versed in science fiction way of doing things, the story concepts tend to make the story seem preposterous and it seems to fall apart. Even so, Siskel and Ebert both said at the time, they both reviewed it and gave it 2 thumbs up. And they said the reason why is, you know, even when the story starts to get crazy, you don't care that it's getting crazy because it just draws you in. It sets this, it's very moody and it sets the story in motion and sets these, you know, makes you sympathize with these deep characters and does so so effectively that when the plot starts to get weird, you don't even care. You're just so wrapped up in the rest of the story. Another comparison we might make would be the storyteller and the programmer for video games or for story games. I remember an old adventure game called Zero Critical by István Pálya. I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He's Russian, and he just told this incredibly great story, but the game itself has bugs. There are aspects to the game which are not stellar. It was overall rated not a great game, although I really enjoyed it, and I played it several times, and I may play it again someday. For the programmer side of things, you can look at, well, a lot of games, including non-story games. I mean, you look at even simple games like Tetris, which has been called a classic. It is a classic. But is it a classic story game? No, it has no story whatsoever. As a result, I, for one, don't have dreams about playing Tetris. I do sit and reminisce about playing Grim Fandango or any of the games by Tim Schafer. Take the latest, Psychonauts, which I highly recommend. It's got great gameplay. It's got an in-depth story. They're both both very tightly integrated, and they both work to draw you in and to keep you playing. You know, maybe there are other aspects. I'm not quite sure how to categorize this, but maybe in general, story design aspects, maybe we could say the storyteller and the designer. I don't know. I'm thinking of things like, you know, for games, as I said, you have the story and the gameplay. And it really helps if they're both strong. For example, you might have plot elements, you know, plot devices. And on the other side, of course, you have the story, which is the way that those plot devices serve the overall story arc. And, you know, maybe it's nice to have great plot devices, creative plot devices. That certainly helps. But sometimes I wonder when critics, they say, oh, well, you know, this particular story had too many action sequences or not enough action sequences or something like that. And there's probably some reason why these critics got the impression that there was too much or not enough. But I highly suspect that that reason has to do with the way that those sequences were integrated into the story overall. All the different design elements that go to make up a story, they really are there, I think, to serve the story. And as long as they do that effectively, then I don't notice them. It doesn't matter if, let's say, you have plot cliches. I don't really care as long as those cliches are not trying to do something new and original. For example, in a character story, sometimes you have plot cliches because all the focus is on the characters. But of course, you do the best when you have both, when you have a strong plot with highly original content and strong, deep, three-dimensional characters that are highly personal. And you introduce these characters to the audience and they become engrossed with the character's story. Then you have the best of both worlds. You have all the story design elements are strong, and the story overall is also strong. Next week, build mood into your stories. This is about playing with the audience's emotions from within the story and from without. So that's next week. For now, thank you very much for listening. If you have a comment or question or suggestion, feel free to email me at timk@bethestory.com or leave a comment on one of the blog entries at bethestory.com or call our audio response line 206-350-STRY. That's 206-350-7879. In any case, have a great week, and I'll see you next week. Bye now.